So I don't know if you want to start with that or just...
I'd be inclined to go. Of course, you would edit this. You'd edit out the hems and haws and
if we pauses. Yeah, if we transcribed it, we would. But
if you used it at all. Mm-hmm. You want to ask me questions?
Well, either way, mm-hmm. could start off with what the department was like when you came here in 1947.
It was close to ideal size. I think of an ideal size as maybe around 17 for a department like economics, in which you'd have two or three people in most all the major fields, and not one only, and not zero. And 40's too big, it's too big now. 5 is too small. I was once a one-man department, so I'm sensitive to that. Although being a one-man department has some advantages. There is no one to say no to you. You are the ultimate wisdom on any subject you care to talk about. I think there were about 17 when I first came. It was in the timing. It was in the waning days of institutionalism. Now, I know some people, like, say, Don Cannell, maybe, would not really quite like that, but I think it's true. This department had been notable in the country for its institutional or descriptive emphasis, in which it said, well, we shouldn't try to make formal logical patterns, paradigms, as they're often called now, to interpret society and economic society. What we need to do is look at the facts, which are bloody awful, which are all complicated, confused, but let's get at them, at the facts. Well, this went on for some years with great success. This department had, I think, a few years ago, the most PhDs. Is my voice too soft or too loud? Or? The most PhDs of any department in the United States, and that may well be true now. I'm just haven't looked at it lately. Some people might feel that's a mixed blessing, not altogether to be proud of, but there's some aspects of pride involved. People wanted to come here. And this was based on its institutional background, historical, descriptive, eschewing theory, pretty much. And the department was getting, in the 1940s, maybe even the late 1930s, uncertainly self-conscious about this reputation. It had the feeling that economics was moving on to other pastures, and that maybe the department was itself just ticking behind, chewing the grasses of the old pasture too long. It had loyal support, but uneasy support from its members. It had a great deal of inbreeding. It had hired its own people, and was a little worried about that. it had found in the past none so suitable as its own brightest and best, but it began to worry, and by the early 1940s, it had made contact with Blackie Ellsworth, P.T.L., Paul T. Ellsworth, Paul Theodore Ellsworth, who was from where? From Oregon, from Oxford, he was a Rhodes Scholar, from Harvard, Ph.D., and from the University of Cincinnati, brought him here in international trade. International trade is a fine home for theoretical approaches, and anybody who doesn't have a bit of theory is just lost to grace in this field. So it was natural they would like to have Blackie Ellsworth come here. He was then, I think, the number one break in the tradition, and maybe I was the second, 1947, from Harvard. Jim Early, well, that's a mixed case. Jim had had taken work here. He may have even have his doctorate from here. I think he does. But also he'd gone to the London School of Economics, LSE, where he admired the uncertain, sometimes uncertain wisdom of John Maynard Keynes at that time. He had some good stories about Keynes. And so the precedent was broken. Oh, I have my notes here. Blackie Ellsworth has a unique distinction in all history, so far as human records go, of being the only bureaucrat who recommended the abolition of his own department. I just present this up for challenge for anybody who knows any other bureaucrat in any century or country, which was the Bureau, the Office of Economic Warfare during World War II. He thought it wasn't useful and said, let's throw it out. Even President Reagan, I guess, loses out in this competition. He's not asked to have the presidency abolished, not yet. Well, when a new candidate was brought in the 1940s, I was first brought here fresh out of Harvard, I think it was. Fresh out of my doctorate, rather. Mm-hmm. About 1942, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And nothing came of that, and I taught 1 year down in Virginia at Randolph Macon Women's College, where it was a one-man department, and came back to Harvard and taught there for some years. And then 1947 came here, well, after a summer in Washington. I didn't feel I was very useful either in Washington, not compared to at least teaching. Mm-hmm. Well, we were, candidates for appointment were inspected. They were for signs of lack of common sense, and for signs of obvious idiocy. Well, and they might be taken up behind the Congregational Church, the big house on University Heights, to indicate what you could do if you behaved yourself and worked hard for 20 years or so. Might live in one of the big houses. And, well, senior professors were relatively higher on the social scale, I think, than they have become later. They were still higher maybe in the 1890s. They would have vacations in Europe to stimulate their thinking. It's not so much lately, really. I come here on my notes to the department's defensive view from the early 1950s. This may be from Don Cannell, may be from Ken Parsons of Ag Econ, both of them. Instead of gnawing at the question, how do things work out when they work perfectly, and developing theoretical systems that were fine if you dismissed all upsetting data with the qualification of other things being equal, ceteris paribus. The Wisconsin School wanted to know how things could be made to work at all, and gave most of its attention to precisely those disorderly factors that somehow never are equal. Well, there was, quotes unquotes, the plea in court for the defense, even for the attack, but somehow economics in large part has moved toward theory and then toward mathematics and econometrics. In the some 20 to 30 years since, 20 to 30 years since, how much of rigor and how much of abstract logic and how much of William James' buzzing confusion of reality and how they should be joined together are the permanent issues in our malaise-afflicted subject. Economics is probably as much in malaise now as it ever has been.
How do you personally feel about the direction in which economics is
going? It's partly benevolent and partly idiosyncratic and pathological. It's partly benevolent in its desire to measure things. I think, let's see, who was it? He was a British scientist who said, unless you measure your ideas are meager and imperfect. And there's been the attempt to measure more and more, which is desirable to quantify. Professor Viner at Chicago says, and if you do measure, your ideas are meager and imperfect, which is certainly true. And his colleague, let's see, That was Knight of Chicago. It was Viner who said, if you can't measure, measure anyhow. Mm-hmm. And that maybe comes to the kind of criticism that one may give. I think that all academic subjects have the tendency to seek honorific and publishable lines of development. And in economics, the articles increasingly consists of equations based on data, and often the basic concepts themselves aren't very applicable, aren't very congruent to the data that are used, and a great deal of superstructure of logical reasoning, econometric reasoning, equations are based on this. So that I think there is a worry about the unprecedented esoteric development of economics. We once had a Nobel Prize winner give us a lecture up above. He filled two boards full of equations, and erasing that finally, started on a third board. And one muses over this as to whether really reality is approach more closely by this kind of abstractions. So I think it's partly simply an academic kind of pathology of refining and refining, refining on refinements, moving on in directions. These are publishable, and assistant professors are desperate to have their title changed to associate professor, tenure, and so they will do what is publishable. And the journals are filled with these things. But thank goodness for democracy and this field and others. You can work on anything in the way you like and make use of the new tools so far as you think they're useful and so far as one is able to use them and make use of verbal analysis or descriptive materials so far as you think that's useful. Well, I've talked too long about that, haven't I, maybe? The malaise is real, says Paul Samuelson. Well, the department, of course, expanding rapidly. We were in the Sterling Hall, the physics building at that time, and we went up to the third floor, and we passed just delightful a little museum of things to do in physics. And I often would stop on the way up or way down and play with those wonderful devices that they have there. We're underprivileged here in this building in that respect. But, of course, when time went on, this building was developed mainly by federal grants. Thank goodness that Reagan wasn't around then. In two installments, and this building came by way of a judicious compromise. Many lovers of nature said that thou shalt not build in the ravine, and more practical people who liked the viewpoint here and who were looking at the lake said we want to build in that gulch. And the compromise was you can have one building there, but you must never, never, never build anything else over into these beautiful woods. Let the trees fall down there as they will in the woods. So that was just marvelous. We don't have any building to compete with this. I'm all in favor of ecology up to that point. The department was well placed here then, and somehow we had social anthropology in the same building. Political science, by some misadventure, was put elsewhere. Often you'd think that it's closer, but rather closer to economics than maybe the others. Well, Bronfenbrenner came here from Chicago, Martin Bronfenbrenner. Martin was, of course, bright. He was also a bit acerbic. He was rough on the outside. He was nice on the inside. He had grave doubts about institutionalism and was not quiet about complaining. Blackie Ellsworth also thought standards aren't high enough. They pass anybody. not quite true. I remember only one case, a near Easterner, who threatened to commit suicide if we didn't pass him. I thought really he ought to go back to beginning economics. But I think he got away finally through our charity and through his threats, possibly through our charity, let's say, with his degree, whatever it was. I hope it wasn't a PhD. I hope it wasn't an MA, but I'm afraid it was. Well, back to the Near East, where perhaps he's joined one of the groups there that are fighting each other. Well, Martin Braun from Benner was here. Left later to go to Michigan State, to go to Minnesota, to go down to Duke. Martin said it was a mistake. And as I'm not as well organized probably as I should, but these things come along. Martin illustrates the ability of economics to go astray. Here he is, bright and student. He loved Japan. And after his first marriage broke up, he married a Japanese girl with, I think, the sensible viewpoint they were brought up properly to be concerned, deferential, looked after men with the greatest of diligence, brought up properly to be diligent wives. Quite successful. Teruko has done this ever since. She didn't like Japan much. Martin loved Japan. And Martin just didn't see how Japan could possibly feed itself, could possibly have any decent standard of living after the war, in view of the fact it had to import so much of foodstuffs and other supplies. How in the world could it ever export enough to buy what it had to import? Well, people go astray. The department also brought in, as it broke away from its precedent of inbreeding, bringing in Jean Rotwine from Chicago. And Jean was here for quite a number of years. Jean was more tolerant, more peaceful. Well, yes, at least he wasn't so clearly acerbic on the surface, though he could be negative about matters. And said an older resident of one of these new people, whose name I'll forbear to mention, when he gets the ball, he will run fast, but you can't tell what goal he'll run to. And in those days, one could. I remember once at an AEA meeting in the 50s, be introduced from Chicago and be rudely met with the response, "Oh, one of those institutional fellows." Well, I've spoken of the growth of theory, and especially of mathematical economics and econometrics. About 1967, I remember one of our senior professors saying kindly to another, who was besieged and dismayed by the onslaughts of equations and of rigor, "The fashion has passed its peak and it's declining." Mm. Not true.
Well, where did you fit in when you came here in terms of the theory versus institutionalism or whatever?
Oh, I was viewed as promising, and I probably had acquired uncertain kinds of knowledge, not necessarily wisdom, but abilities from my graduate training. And apparently I'd been well spoken of. So I was viewed as, with some uncertainty, as being promising, I guess. And what I did was to follow into trade, primarily. Mm-hmm. Black and I, we introduced the first course in economic development. Blackie had been hired by the World Bank to be the head of a mission to Colombo in Ceylon. I'm being untactful, said one of our other professors, Ceylon. Bangkok is its capital, right?
Well, the names of countries change.
They change, yes. I don't like Sri Lanka. But Blackie was there about 1951 or 2, and I went over as an advisor to the Central Bank of Ceylon 1951-53. So that pulled us into economic development. Mm-hmm. And when we came back, we started the first course. It was a great success. 474, I called, because I wanted to say, think it was a little bit higher than 460 for international trade. Not necessarily tall. But we had then these two fields, and I was associated more with economic development for quite a while. I was interested in business cycles and trade, of course.
You wrote a textbook back in that period of time.
Yeah, it's a good one. Textbooks come and go. I guess one doesn't think of them quite as textbooks. You think of them as contributions.
Oh.
You think of it as pushing the field forward and onward and upward. Well, when I came here, the department was in sharp, very sharp conflict, not over really quite institutionalism in theory, but over the personality of one of the professors. Should I name names and so on?
Might as well.
Well, everybody who knows anything about the department knows the names. Walter Morton, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And Walter was was profane and loud in his convictions, and he was... he didn't have any mild convictions. All his convictions were extremely firm. He would express his views sometimes with profanity down the hall. Those of us who were more tender-spirited, like myself, would sort of close the door and try not to hear what was going on. You couldn't be sure that Walter was 100% wrong. That made it awkward, you see, difficult. There's, see, some people you can always, you know, they're wrong, whatever they say is wrong, so you don't have to worry about it. Walter might be right or partly right. For example, he carried on a long campaign in faculty meetings against boxing on the grounds it was the only sport in which you tried with mayhem and deceit to slay your opponent, and he didn't think this was a sensible kind of sport. I think I agree with him. A miserable kind of thing to do, but some people seem to like to watch it. The department meetings often were very tense. You'd go away somewhat shaken. It was better to have a bit of Equinol or Meprobamate before one went into department meetings.
This was during what period?
Probably 50s, late 40s and 50, in the 50s. And I'm sure that Ed Whitty, who was the chairman, had a very hard time out of it, and he was probably injured his health a bit in the conflicts. There was finally, when Ed Young was then chairman of the department, a notable meeting called in President Fred's office. Ed Young had, I guess, negotiated and said, could we have a meeting to talk over our problems? Now, it happened that Walter Morton was not here at that time. And I don't know what sort of benevolent chance brought this about. But in any case, the department was there except for Walter. And Martin Glazer was there, who was rather tended to go along with Walter and most things. President Fred, I remember this notable meeting. Is there anything I can do for you? He asked politely as we gathered in. Then one after another, mature economists spoke rather briefly with the unanimous sentiment that life in the department life was difficult. That's all that happened. Nothing was ever done aside from this. Walter came back, and he was sort of dismayed at the report. There was more equanimity, there was less Equinol and Meprobamate. Life was better. In other words, there was a bit of social pressure that was brought within the department. Berkeley, in comparison, had just almost a total breakdown through I don't know what sort of combination of personal tensions. And they brought in a friend of mine who is now Prime Minister. He was one of my best friends in graduate school, now Prime Minister of Greece, Andy Papandreou, Andreas Papandreou, who came to Berkeley. And he was brought in simply as an outsider to ameliorate, to soften the warfare, apparently. Mm. Well, that was a more extreme case than here. But I'm all in favor of democracy. Social pressure is better than shooting people, by far. Democracy, tolerance, and consensus. Hiroshima argues that these are critical for productivity, thinking of Japanese history. Well, Alma Bridgman was for decades, up to 1968, the firm prime minister of the department, of our department. The faculty and students alike obeyed her mandates and sometimes trembled before her, probably for the general welfare. She could and she would enter classrooms, and professors were often rather feel they're on their dignity a bit in the classroom. But she could and would open the door and shush down the professor and make an announcement. And this bothered them a bit. But she did it all she was thoroughly patriotic. She did it for the general good. Well, came expansion. In the late 50s and the 60s, the students came and the money came. Oh, yes, there had been the GIs a little earlier in the early 50s. And they were the best students I think we've ever had as a group, because they were older and they knew what they wanted. So they worked hard. They wanted to make the most of this wonderful opportunity that they had. But expansion continued after the GIs had come and gone. The numbers grew and grew, the department, until it has come to an astonishing over 50, and now it's shrunk. It shrunk a bit. I think it's in the middle 40s now. But it's very difficult to say how many people you do have, because they're off on leave or working part-time. So it's a kind of theoretical matter. There was, during this period, a delicate and nervously monitored treaty with commerce as to what courses were owned by whom. And I'm thinking of...
it's Heraclitus, isn't it?
Who said of the gods we know, of men we know, and of the gods we believe that they rule wherever they can. And this occurs in all sorts of social situations, within families, within departments. Perhaps he's not always completely correct. We had as our kind of warrior for the department, Walter Morton, ideal, an ideal character for the purpose. He would scare perhaps even Dean Elwell. I never met Dean Elwell, not to my knowledge, but I thought of him as something like a dragon. Over there. The question was, should given courses in theory be here in economics or in commerce? Should some be given both? And there was an agreement, and Walter looked after the interests of the economics department with great vigor, perhaps excessive vigor, and in time that waned, became less interesting. One of the characteristics of the department is that leaves have been given liberally, so that there's been quite a plus to Wisconsin compared to many other departments of economics and, I suppose, other departments. So that in my own case, I think I was away something like 7 times for a year and a half to 2 years, once 2 years, most a year and a half, most in the Far East. Twice to England, but once after I became emeritus to England. In any case, the free leaves, the willingness to have people take leaves, has been quite a plus to life in the department. About economic development, which I had some special interest, meaning economic advance for less developed countries. Now, this started in 1953 with our first course, as I've mentioned before, and swelled until at one time, perhaps maybe 15 years ago, there were as many graduate students in that one field as in all the other fields combined. Just quite remarkable. Yeah. And now it's shrunk. Oh, yeah. I don't know whether partly less developed countries are becoming, some of them are being successful, especially in the Far East. There are perhaps 5 countries in the Far East that are just outstanding in the world in their rate of growth. Mm-hmm. And partly through ill success, countries in Africa. If one's a pessimist, you'd say that there, a number of them are moving back toward the isolated, ineffective economies of the jungle. Good. In both cases, I suspect political and social reasons being very important. The economists talk about economics, but maybe they ought to talk about these other matters more. So, but in any case, whether for success or failure or some combination, interest in economic development has shrunk, and until it's very small now, and now no one field dominates. The 1950s and 60s, when the students and income, as I mentioned, were growing rapidly, collapsed into the age of disillusion and alienation in fullest flood about 1967 to 70. And I remember sitting in this office hearing the roar of the crowd down at the front of Bascom Hall. And I just tried not to hear. I thought of it as 1,000 feet and no head.
I'm going to just have to flip the tape here.
Okay. It was Walter Badgett who says, so long as human reason is weak and human emotions are strong, the course of progress is uneven. And I've been looking lately. It's just curious as you think of, when you have a bit of perspective, to think of the ebb and flow of conventional attitudes. Mm-hmm. The alienation, everything it is wrong, you might say, and we've got to go out throw things down, interrupt classes, and so on, has moved toward quite an opposite kind of emphasis, of which I gather the extreme case is that of students in France, who from rioting only a few years ago now are seen distinguished for their conservatism, for their disillusionment with maybe both left and right and politics, with politics as a whole, saying that we want to get jobs. And thinking of an article recently on this. Well, we moved away from those unhappy times. My personal, two cases. I remember bicycling down University Avenue and hearing a bump, bump down at the end of the block, and saw a lot of people there. And then the whiff of tear gas walked toward me. I hastily retreated, a coward totally, up a side street, to trying to get away from that. I remember going up to a meeting, too, in 8417, where some student politician was orating about the extreme troubles that we were in due to the wickedness of whom, I don't know anybody even mentioned, capitalists, teachers, administration, government, wickedness. And well, one of the faculty members in labor economics, I saw him shake his head, walk out the door. I did too. It was the proper, I guess, counter-argument. Well, we moved away from those curious and unhappy times, and I think students and faculty now are inclined to work away in their at their less, melancholily or happily. And a brave new world is unlikely. And we in economics drift between the precise and the real less uneasily than we should. And I think there's notable that the aims of students and younger professors are practical. It's harder to obtain tenure now than it used to be. And the canons may be a little, well, they vary depending on the committees involved, but the effort is there. Bureaucracy grows with size. One worries about that, but it's inevitable that you do have procedures routinized into committees, which take a great deal of time. They take time away from other activities that you often think are worthier. At the same time, you have a sense of accomplishment. Yes, I went to a committee for 2 or 3 or 4 hours, and I don't feel very well. It's been sitting too much. But you feel as if you've maybe done what you should have done. But maybe you should have done other matters, such as writing books. Mm-hmm. Well, I've gone discursively through things.
What committees especially have you been on?
Oh, gosh, so many that I forget about them. One blessed committee on campus peace. I was the chairman of that. And Ed Young was then the chancellor, or president, chancellor, yes, must have been chancellor. And a number of us were alarmed at the degree of alienation and disruption. And so, in the conventional reaction of the administrator in the office, you appoint a committee to look into things. And we were active for 2 years. And we heard various people come. We heard Ralph Hansen, campus police, and other people come. We had some students come and talk. And maybe it had some very mild usefulness. Mm. In any case, it was something to do. Kind of ritualistic response. And that was for the university. And we've had all sorts of department committees, of course, mm-hmm. many of which were on just because we're here, either as senior faculty or as faculty.
One thing I kind of wanted to ask you about was the Gajah Mada project. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Yes, I haven't talked really particularly about my own activities, but I went 2 years to Ceylon as advisor to Central Bank and deputy governor of Central Bank finally, Sri Lanka now. And a year and a half was a Ford Foundation supported project at Gajah Mada, which means wise elephant, university in the middle of Java. Adventure, of course. I would ask the family if I wanted to go somewhere. Ask Kathy and the children, who are small, 3 girls, uh-huh. Do you want to go so-and-so? And we get a chorus. There'd be a chorus of, yes, yes, let's do. Year and a half there at Yogyakarta in central Java, a kind of cultural, historical center. Very much overheated, but we were probably there. Elisa Tarko was kind of the main person who administered the project from here, most diligently and tactfully indeed. she came on when we were out there. Reed Tripp was one of the earliest people there, went to Lehigh University, and others. I was there a year and a half, others followed. And we trained a lot of people. It makes a real difference to a country, I think, that our several scores of people trained at Wisconsin, at Berkeley, at Harvard, and elsewhere have gone back to be teachers and also government bureaucrats, officers. And I don't think there's any doubt the Ford Foundation rightly thought that this could make a difference to the economic, well, social development of the country. It's now complete. We don't have any more, unless just ad hoc now and then some people come. We've had some people out of being in Ceylon. We have 3 of the officers of the Central Bank
from Wisconsin, including governor now, Dominic Abusacra, with his brother working over here in a printing shop about 10 miles out of town. Permanently, well, of course, Sri Lanka's come on difficult times. What will happen out of the nascent civil war is uncertain there. Too bad, because the Tamils and Sinhalese seem to be getting along all right when you were there. Well, Indonesia went through an absolute fracas, of course, mainly after we were there, kind of quasi-communist, and probably it's a very mixed rebellion, with just absolute slaughter of something like up to half a million people, no one knows, killed, with old grudges being settled finally, competitions, social and political, I guess, entering into it. And I believe that one or two of our own people were killed in that. Time goes on. And I myself worked after that in Singapore for a year and a half, Economic Research Center, under Ford support. Mm-hmm. And advised the government of Thailand one summer. And I worked for the World Bank in Kenya, worked for the Council of Economic Advisors. This going back and forth from other activities is very stimulating to a faculty, and I think through the faculty to students. And more recently, I worked for the Asian Development Bank, if you want to ask me about my own activities. And I'm going out there. I wonder why the Asian Development Bank was set up in Manila. It looks as if the Philippines are going to have a hard 10 years ahead, let's say, as the Marcos regime disintegrates, more or less. Something else follows. It may have a civil war, according to one prediction, within 2 or 3 years, well, more formally than now. So the bank ought to have been put elsewhere with a better climate. Manila's so hot. If you go out for your morning jog, you come back just dripping. Sejinaya, who was one of our graduate students, again, was the direct economics director there. And he developed a 10-kilometer run, a 6-kilometer run to keep people interested and healthy and active, which was a good thing for the bank. I've worked there, and I will work at the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii this winter, this coming winter. And we've been in England, as I've mentioned twice, for a total of 3 years, at Sussex, University of Sussex, the Economic Development Institute there, and also at the University of Manchester, north of England. Mm-hmm. And there's been a great deal more, I think, of that coming and going, probably even now more recent in the last 10 years than there would have been, certainly in the 40s and earlier. And it is a stimulus, although there's a certain amount of disruption. I once met Fred, our past president. Never mind. The president of the university in Alice Springs in Central Australia. And he was a little surprised to find me out there. It's all right for president to go around. And he said, "How often, Ted?" I knew him before. "Fred, there." No,
help you out with the name there.
No, it's nuts. It's almost there. And I mentioned a number of times I've been away about every 5 or 6 years. Well, he said, "I think that's all right." Had this imprimatur, this blessing on activities. Well, let's see, what else can I mention? Oh, the changes in incomes, the teaching load is less.
What was the deal? retention load at the time you came?
Normally around 3 classes, I think. I had usually a week. Meeting would be 9 hours a week of teaching. But of course, it's a very ambitious department. Being ranked rather consistently in the popularity polls, not that you take them too seriously, at perhaps 9 or 10 or 11 in the country, having maintained that level, and having some very distinguished graduates too. Oh, income levels, it's curious to think of that too. I guess the income level's approaching now 20 times in dollars what it was when I came. It hasn't quite gotten there. It's maybe it's closer to around 16 or 17 times. And nevertheless, as I suggest, if you go back maybe 80 years or so, I think the relative level of professors in our major universities has fallen. So one shouldn't think in dollar terms only, you should think in real terms or relative real terms. As Dusenberry would argue, especially. Well, what have I missed? And you probably inquired of other people and you get different sorts of emphases. They're all over the map, are they?
Right, yeah, that's one of the reasons we want to get around, talk to as many people as we can, so that doesn't just turn out to be one
of the There's a certain lightheadedness.
If you think of something else, or...
Well, there's such complications. I was thinking again of this Walter Badgett, the first editor, I guess it was, of The Economist. Human reason is weak and human emotions are strong. So you have a rather confused picture. As you look back on things.
So what about the, when you first came here, did the faculty socialize together a lot? I mean, did you get to know all the other people on the faculty?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it's really gotten too big. You lose track first of the wives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the wife is a teacher, then of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
But there's almost all wives, you lose track of them first, and then you lose track of the others, especially younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Who's that? Well, they say the same thing. Who's that guy? As they come in. So that, for example, renting our house during our period in Hawaii this winter to one of the members of the department, I didn't know him, he didn't know me. We were both surprised. Finally, we were of the department. That wouldn't have been true. And the department was much smaller. So I guess I come out with a kind of benevolent generality of attitude toward what has happened in the department. All in favor of democracy. It's a terrible system, but it's better than any other, as Churchill said.